Okay, the first order of business is the approval of the previous meeting minutes, which have already been distributed. We have a motion.
I'll move.
Moved by Ben. Second. Brown, all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Hearing none, motion carries. Pity item number one, land water update. Mr. Cook?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In FY06, just to update you gentlemen on two or three things here, we increased the total number of wildlife management plan to 5,482 different plans across the state, covering just under 19 million acres. And that represents an approximate doubling of plans and acres since FY01. So that program is going well. We believe there's still a lot of opportunity out there, a lot of interest, and we continue to work hard to get those plans in place and folks involved in that process. At the direction of the 79th Texas Legislature, the Coastal Fisheries Division has been exploring a rural proposal that would allow private citizens, organizations, or corporations to participate in our artificial reef program in a more direct way. The results of scoping and the public hearing process will be brought to you during today's meeting. Finally, offshore mariculture is a growing industry worldwide. Recent inquiries involving the Gulf of Mexico have revealed that our rules cannot address this potential industry in their current form. The results of scoping and public hearing process will be brought to you in today's meeting. That's all I have. Any questions?
Question. AD item number 2007, 2008, statewide hunting and fishing proclamation preview. Dr. McKinney. Hey,
Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, I'm Michael Aaron McKinney, Director of Coastal Fisheries. I've asked Robin Riker, our Director of Science and Policy, to join me up here so we can go through this with you. We have these items here, five items that we are proposed to go out on scoping with this round, so I want to go over those with you a little bit, starting with our primary one, spotted sea trout, which we briefed you on this fairly thoroughly previously, but I want to cover a couple of the important aspects of where we are on this particular proposal. And really, it revolves around, and again, we've given you quite a bit of information in past briefings, but from the biological perspective, it revolves around three pieces of information which I'd like to go ahead and present to you, and this is one of them that has certainly come to our attention and that we're concerned about, and that is our population levels in Laguna Madre, where in the statewide, in all of our bays, every one of them statewide, we've seen a steady increase in our numbers of spotted sea trout, as shown here. In the lower Laguna Madre is the one area in which that population numbers have gone down over the same period of time. In fact, this year, for the first time, the population levels in the lower Laguna Madre dropped below the statewide average. So there's a situation going on there that's not going on elsewhere in the state that we need to take a look at, and we are. This is the other slide, and this is a spawning stock biomass, and really what that means is this is by town, the number of female fish that are in spawning situation that can't contribute to a spawn in any particular area. And you can see the trend here is certainly downward and of concern to us. Now, right now, in the Laguna Madre, we don't really have a recruitment problem. There's sufficient biomass there to fill up the available habitat. It's there. But as this trend continues down, and we get into situations like a freeze or a red tide or something like that, our ability to recover from those situations depends on a sufficient biomass to do so. This is of concern. And the third graph, it talks about length frequency issues and about how our fish, what pressure are on our fish. We know we have some issues in the lower Laguna Madre from an environmental perspective we're looking at. And we have that up and down the coast, but there's clearly some areas we're looking at there as well. But one of the questions, of course, is, you know, why is the population going down? What's contributing to that downward trend? And this particular graph, I think, speaks to that. And when you look at how where the fish are disappearing from, once the fish pass that minimum length, you can see they begin to shift. We're losing, in the last few years, more fish. They start dropping out in that 18 to 20 inches. That's a classic fishing pressure graph. I mean, there may be issues going on there, but fishing pressure is contributing to the decline of that population. This points that out, so we know that that is a factor, and that's a factor we can address directly and take a look at it. Now, this issue has been so important to us. Of course, we have already been out scoping and talking to folks about it ahead of our normal scoping process. And one of the issues that we've been laying out on the table is this an opportunity or a time for us to take a look at regional arrays? We typically have not done that. We talked about that here before the commission, and we've always done statewide regulations. But is this the time that we begin to address some of these issues on a regional level? Is this the best approach to do it to address this problem, and can it fit? And that's something we have scoped and looked at, and we certainly think there's an opportunity to do that. And there's a lot of opinions on that. I'm sure you've heard them, and we'll hear them. But that's what this whole process is about, is to get that input. Just to give you a little update on our recent scoping meetings, we did begin to lay out some scenarios of what would we do, what kind of regulations would we look at on a regional basis. And of course, they really fall into two areas. One is changing the minimum length and changing bag limits, or some combination of those. And so we modeled all of those priorities, for example, increasing the minimum size length to 16 inches, decreasing the bag limits by 7, 6, 5, or even 3 fish, and those combinations. One way to look at it is on this table here. And one decision that we did make pretty quickly is that the option of looking at increasing the minimum length of catch up to 16 really didn't get us where we wanted to go. It didn't hit where we wanted on some of the spawning biomass and some of those other issues. And as a way to kind of keep it simple, we said, let's just take a look at bag limits so we don't have any kind of comments. Let's look at the most simple approach. And of course, these are the options here. And as you might expect, the more restrictive you are, the more quickly you get, the better results you get. And in fact, about half your benefits in the first 2 to 3 years. It's a kind of a curve that goes up. You see an increase in the spawning biomass and the populations very quickly in the first 2 or 3 years, and then it begins to taper off. But you get some pretty quick results in that period of time.
What's this inflation based on? These previous?
These are models.
These are our models.
Okay. These are based on these models.
So certain rates of growth? Or
yes, and population levels, and based on our own data that we collect. And because it's based on that data, they're very good. I mean, we in a lot of places where you don't have good information for models, we do. And so the models are pretty good. That's proven to be the case.
Is this specific to the lower laguna?
Yes, sir.
Which is the northern border of the Laurel Laguna is which is what?
Planka. And then that's one of the bigger questions.
What other issues could you attribute this to other than just fishing pressure?
Well, one of the things we're looking at, there is a confined area down there. There is a lot of growth in that area, certainly. The Roy, Colorado, and other discharges are coming in there with tremendous conversion over from ranching to intensive agriculture. The population growth down there is just off the charts. We've had brown tides and red tides. There's a series of things that no doubt are having effect in that area that we're having to contend with.
So,
but on the other hand, when you take a look at other sport fish like red drum, are record numbers down there. I mean, we've never seen red drum like that ever.
Now, I think Commissioner Devin's question, though, is, I believe, was answered by Randy. Life Hunter's up here on the water quality issue, and if maybe...
I've got just some letters recently from people claiming that, the economic impact of this is going to be devastating to the fishing guys, which I know you're aware of.
Sure.
And then also there's silting issues that they think contribute more to this than the actual fishing pressure.
Oh, for the main still? Well, I can respond to it this way. Spotted sea trout, their reproductive patterns, they stay within an estuary that they're in pretty much. They may go up to the path a little bit, but they mostly, they're an estuary and fish. They hang in their body of water. Redfish, on the other hand, of course, they school up in November and get offshore. They go through their spine and eggs drift back in on current. Now, there's no doubt that the shoaling and mansfield and so forth is an issue for both sides. I mean, that's something we'd like to see something change there. But one indication of is there sufficient water exchange to support the system is redfish. Red drum are just off the charts in that area. So that gives me some indication, at least from a biological perspective, our water exchange is adequate.
Well, the other thing is the recruitment to our gillnets, which is basically a larger size fish, as Larry mentioned earlier, recruitment has not dropped yet. So we're actually reaching the fishery size, the catchable size fish, and they're dropping after that period of time. And really the mortality that occurs after that period of time is mostly man.
And that's a key point. I appreciate you bringing that. That's exactly right. That chart I showed you, we go back to it as well. I think it's important. This is an important topic here. When we look at that type of thing, those fish up to that point, up to getting into the legal size fish, we're getting recruitment sufficient, you know, to hit those population numbers. But where the fish begin to disappear is at the size where you catch them. So that's there. Now, to respond to your question about the economics, and that's, I understand that. But the question from a biological perspective, my response to that is, you need to pay now, or you pay later. But if I look at these trends, if you're going to wait another 4 to 6 years, I'll come back and tell you, guys, we'll be closing season, or we'll be doing some other things, because our options will be much less.
Larry, are these fish too delicate to have a slot like you have for redfish?
Well, we don't really have one almost.
Well, okay. In the, you know, if you had a 15 to...
You're talking about catch mortality from catch release?
Yeah.
No, they're not really. I mean, you've got some...
Well, from a release mortality standpoint, it's not really a... Basically, most of the fish survive when we were dealing with this issue in the early 2000s. We get a great deal of survival of those fish. But the most important part about the difference in the characteristics is this fish only lives to 7 or 9 years. And so as they don't have the same characteristics. What we're trying to do with the sliding red drum is escape fish to the Gulf to spawn, and that's just not the issue here. We already have them to the spawning age. They're disappearing after. Our minimum size limit is already set where they live.
But spawning age is what, 20 inches?
No, more like 12 to 14.
Yeah, they're
12 or 14.
Not half the spotted sea trout are in 1 year, they're sexually mature. Then in 2 years, it's 70-80%. So they're whacking it. They're in their area.
When we changed from a 12 to a 14, we were trying to guarantee spawning success. And so that really is,
biological term.
Yeah, it's a whack.
Now, let's talk about water quality and the numbers of the sea trout. Now, if you is there a little line there going across there? Is there a little green line going across there about halfway up?
Could be. That's probably not a scale map. That's probably a county line there or something.
A county line or something.
That's
so then...
you think of Arroyo or something?
Yeah. No, I wasn't thinking about that, but what... Do we have the numbers of sea trout in the north half as opposed to the numbers of sea trout in the lower half?
No, our sampling scheme is basically a system. But we do a randomized sample type thing. We don't sample sufficiently to parse out any of our systems. It's just system wide. I don't think there's anything we can do with that.
Okay. What I was trying to, you mentioned the Arroyo, Colorado a moment ago. And do you have any information with respect to the quality of water near and around the Arroyo, Colorado?
Well, do, and in fact, there are some issues there. And as I was reminded earlier, that the Arroyo, although I tend to think of the Arroyo because I think it's a big source, there are other inputs as well, a few other tributaries, but there are some issues there. And we have a group that's working with ATEQ on a PMDL study for that area too. So there's our guys begin to look at it, and there's some relationships in there that I can't quite sort out, but there's something there. And our guys are going to look at it and are looking at it to see if we can figure it out. But that, it's part of the issue. But there's no doubt that we have changed that dynamic down there. There's some large
volume. Because, you know, there's been a population explosion and, like you say, an exchange in agricultural uses of
land.
And more things maybe will get to kind of worry down there that may have some sort of influence in the reproductive process of fish down on the lower part. You know, I would think that we would want to know those things.
Well, the thing with that on the environmental side of it, those are long-term issues. I'm going to deal with those no matter what. And we're going to go at it. But they don't stop that. No matter what happens down there, a lot of which is not in our control, we still have to portion out that fishery so we can make sure it does the best it can. So it's kind of a two-pronged kind of deal. There's just no way. That's one thing we can't control, and we'll have to deal with no matter how good or how bad the water quality of Laguna Madre gets. We need to trust the boat, and we're going to do that, but we have to do a vote.
Yeah, I don't think it should be looked at as this is an alternative to dealing with the other issues. The other issues are there, and we're working with TCEQ to advance that. But the data is pretty clear that you've still got recruitment to that cascade. So the weak link is not right now recruitment of biomass to that point. The weak link may be water quality and quantity in the future, but today the evidence doesn't show that.
This is what we propose to go out and scope. Here are the options. Basically, here are some options to look at.
The harvest line, obviously, there's variability there. Is that an input in the model?
The harvest basically is based on current recreational fishing mortality and current fishing pressure, and so the model, one of the outputs of the model is to basically estimate what the change would have in regards to harvest. And that's obviously one of the reasons we threw the 10 fish, 16 inch minimum. The minimum size limit immediately has a 25% reduction in the harvest level, so it wasn't as palatable an option in our mind as some of the other options that are on the table there, where people would still be able to go and harvest fish at near the same levels, but we still get an increase in the overall biomass and an increase in the population abundance over time.
So you're saying if we went with the 10 fish minimum 16 inch, we would have a 25% reduction in the harvest.
Right where that, yeah.
And that would be second only to the 3 fish minimum 15.
That's correct, but it didn't, and one of the reasons why we went ahead and kind of moved it off the table was it didn't necessarily change as much the spawning biomass and then the total population as some of the other options that we had.
Gives you relatively little on the population increase of large fish.
Yeah, I will say we're still in the scoping phase, so I don't think, while we may have looked at this option as not as feasible an option, it'll really be January when we come to you with a proposal stating what the SAB proposal is at that right time. So certainly in our next scoping phase, the 10 fish, 16 inch minimum could be discussed, as well as even we have had some discussions about changing other statewide rules and not do a regionalization.
But I mean, 10 fish doesn't really mean anything, but the average is far less than that anyway, right?
Do we have a...
I'm sorry, what's the average? And do we have it for the lower limit?
I'll have to get a price for this low.
Do we have a timeline? In other words, if we implement the first, second, third, fourth, or fifth, is there a timeline as to any... as to when we would achieve what we want to achieve from a time perspective? In other words, if we implement the 10, it'll take us 4 years to get there.
Well, the bad news, of course, is that that the life expectancy of these fish are 7 to 9 years, so in order for a regulation to have its full effect, you're going to have to go through an entire life cycle of fish, 7 to 9 years. But what the model does on the plus side is
a great percentage of those benefits, the increases in the large fish and the spawning biomass occurs in the first 3 years. You get a big curve, and then it begins to level off. So you get a big bang in the first
but that
3 years.
But you think that big bang is going to reach a level to restore it to where it should be?
If you wonder, well, what should it be?
What it should be is in comparison to the upper Laguna Madre. In other words, there's got to be a standard to which we're shooting for.
My goal right now on these things is to turn the spawning biomass curve and that population curve around to start it up. Then we can come back and say, okay, do we want to back off or do we want to stay on this? Whatever it takes to keep that trend up is where I want to go. I want to turn it. That's my first goal.
But we then take that spiral or that upside, and what do we compare that to what the upper Laguna Madre is doing? What's the comparison
here
to?
Was the change in the lower Laguna Madre numbers, and so lower Laguna Madre until just most recently, the last data samples, was still at or near the top of our base systems, but it wasn't equal to its historic highs, and so that's what we're trying to...
Okay, so we're trying to go back to the historical highs at the Laguna Madre, independent of the rest of the system.
And
reverse the trend line.
Okay.
And who knows if this situation, I mean, if this thing goes like we where are we going, this type of thing. When you look at that bottom line population of trout, 25 inches or greater, and you see what happens there, in 3 or 4 years, if we're doing what we would like to see, and we're starting to get bigger trout there, people may say, wait a minute, we don't necessarily want the fish. We like the fact that we got all these big fish. We want to keep on that trend. Then I want to be in a position where we can make some management decisions based on what works best for that system and the people down there.
Larry, you may have said this, and I just didn't hear it, but over what time period do you expect these results?
It'll take, for the full run, it can take up to 9 years, but 3 years is
But that's a 9-year run? That model is the result after 9 years?
Yeah, but
most of it occurs in the first 3.
50-70% after 3, then it's a steady decline. So we'll need to see. It's like on the rules on big trout type thing. About 3 years is what we...
So whether we take the 10 fish, 3 fish, it doesn't make a difference. You still have the same 9-year run.
Yes. That's
yes.
What, if you're going to hit those regs, full line
time. You're drawing the line at the land cut, so you're not including Bass and Bay in there.
No, that's in our upper Laguna Madre.
Yeah. Group. But your numbers coming out of Bass are still... Well, they need to be, so they're still going up
in big trout and lots of trout.
Yeah.
In excellent shape. Excellent shape. Best big trout here we've ever had.
Yeah, this last summer.
Any other questions or discussion?
One question. What do you attribute the Baffin Bay and North?
Mr. Cook's management.
His evaluation's coming up.
Okay. So that's where the other's going down.
Yeah, right.
That's
the only thing where that comes into the evaluation.
Yeah, right. Good answer.
Good answer.
That's all right. It's the new chairman of regs. That's true.
You're out. I'm going to ask you.
I think although my biologist will say we're not really where we need to make that statement yet, but the changes we made in trout regulations before, and they're starting to show up now in 2003 when we did that, I think we're starting to see some of that impact. And we've had a good year. No freezing. I like to take as much.
Yeah, take credit for that.
Do you think freezes in the lower Laguna had any impact in what you're seeing now?
They were devastating. The freezing lower Laguna is just a killer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was morale. I'll show you some pictures. I'm not going to say that. It's just...
I
don't want to see those again. But that's one of the problems. If we get spotting biomass populations down so low, it could take a long time to recover. That's where that biomass business comes in. Good. I'm sorry to proceed with
this is the last panel. Carry on, sorry.
No, unfortunately, I have, this is the board, but I have some other
Let me get through this. Okay, one of the other areas that I take a look at is the sheephead. The sheephead fishery is kind of a whole different perspective on it, but this, as it shows here, comprises about 4% of all our recreational landing. And it's certainly growing in popularity throughout the state. We do have even a commercial fishery with this too. A landing is about 70,000 pounds a year and this type of thing. But one of the things that in our current limits are here, one of the things we want to go out and scope though is to take a look at increasing the minimum size, limit up to 15 inches. And this is on track with a concern of mine, kind of looking down the road situation, is that as our, and the good news is we're going to see more people fishing on the coast. Of course, the bad news is we're going to see more people fishing on the coast. And so I'm seeing a situation, I want to be able to put all of our fisheries, our recreational fisheries, potential fisheries in a situation where those populations have a chance to reach sexual maturity, reproduce, begin to build the population before we start taking them out. And so as we go along, I want to over the years, lay these things up and scope this out to see if we can move that direction so that when the pressure does come on the sheephead and others, that the population will be in a situation to handle it and not wait until we have to react to something and do something more drastic. So that's what we want to go out and scope on sheephead. Even further, the protection of diamondback terrapin. This is a marine turtle. This is an issue. These turtles do occur up and down the coast historically. They're a little more restricted now, but we do find them. They do get taken in our crab traps from time to time. When we look at our crab trap removal program, for example, we have come across them, both dead and alive. And one of the things that some informal information we see that of all the turtles that are taken, 50% of them, we see them in crab traps and shrimp traps. And one of the things that I want to take a look at and scope is that I don't want to get in a situation down the road if these things are listed or not listed now, but they are of concern if they become federally listed or protected. I really don't want to get in a situation, if I can avoid that, of where our crabbers have to have escape panels and heads and crab traps and things like that. I'd rather try to address this up front and just say, let's just not have a no-take situation. When you look on the internet, you begin to see that these terrapins are being sold. Now, they're being captured bred, but some are being captured in the wild, too. But they have some value in this particular ad, $125 a piece for these terrapins. Here's one that kind of scares me, that some fellow wants to buy them by the ton. I'm pretty optimistic as far as I know if you can find a ton of them when they're worth that. But he's talking particularly to crabbers. That gets the crabbers' attention, so we're kind of concerned about that. You can see them want to buy them live. A king snake, a very common size. He had 8 and a half adults. I don't know where that half adult is. It's his juvenile, but he wants to sell them for $3,000 a pair. So the point is, there's value to these things. We want to get ahead of that deal and put out. Let's have a no take on this type of thing. Now I know that we're working very closely with our non-game program, and they're looking at the turtle issue altogether and appropriately. So I know you've heard comments in all of it, and so we want to work with them and kind of scope this out and see what people think about coming up with a note tape for this marine turtle and see where we need to go.
Could we be underestimating bycatch, or maybe a lot higher than we think, or do you think our numbers are good on?
I don't know, Ron, what do you...
Well, we the non-game permit is where we would determine whether or not there's a lot of catch that has been going into some sort of market, but they have to possess greater than 25, and then they also have to have that permit, supposedly, if they're going to sell it. It's our viewpoint, though, that if you're in the crab fishery and you catch a few of these animals, you're not going to catch them in those high quantities. But once they get to their house, it's pretty hard to track what they might be doing. And with the kind of values you're seeing, we would just like that to stop before there's actually a market developed.
And we hope that they're not doing it. And sure. In fact, if we can get ahead of it, there never will be. And the Nolan Church might just think that's part of the deal. On another area, tarpon scoping. You know, we put in effect the rules now that you can keep one fish over our fish over a certain length to go for state record. We have a new state record for tarpon. So caught by off the Galveston Pier on a piece of dead menhaden. So you don't need a boat or anything. You need a dead menhaden head and a line and a steer. You can catch the state record.
Yeah.
At any rate, so one thing we'll have to do, or want to do, is raise the minimum length to 90 inches from 80 inches, so someone could have a chance to get a state record, but just protect all those fish under 90 inches. We got the fish at Expo, which, as you guys know, I guess I've never tried to pick up a 100-pound fish, but I just helped pick that thing up, load it back in the truck, and just weigh it there, about 200 pounds.
Yeah,
a couple of cleanup items.
How the hell would that fish have been?
Well, they can live up to 50 years, 75, 50 to 75 years of age, right. And that fish could be 50.
So any increasing from 80 inches to 90 inches, what would be the age differential more or less?
I'll have to get back. I'm not going to get, but from 50, you know, that range, something like that. Like we have some same age. That's the range of about 40, 50 years.
You can live as long as
that. What would be an average tarpon? I have no idea.
Average
tarpon
size.
Yeah, size wise. Length.
They can do that.
Or you can calculate, I know I've done it, fly fishing for 5 years, you can calculate the, taking the third and the length and calculate the weight within, you know, a pound.
As a matter of fact, we established after dropping the tarpon tag requirements, we did work with the inland and established a catch and release record. And it's based on that record, so you're right. After it. And you can still get a state record without having to bring that fish to shore.
Yeah, IGFA prefers you down. Yeah.
And that's a good trend going. Last few items, we do have on the record books, and this was maybe 10 or 12 years ago, when airboats first started being used on the coast, they would use airboats to herd schools of redfish up in shallow waters, that type of thing, or raft, and so there was a rule passed to not allow airboats to take in that activity. Well, of course, nowadays we have shallow draft boats and others, and that can go in those shallow waters too. So we thought let's just clean this up. Just say no vessel. You can't use a vessel to harass fish. Let's just, in case law enforcement could ever make one of those cases, and they're very difficult to do. We didn't want them to be locked in by just saying it's only airboats if they see that activity. So that was there. And then again, we're going to talk about this later. We need to exempt offshore aquaculture facilities when they have a permit from bag and size limits when they bring these fish in and land them from the commercial operation. Clearly, they could be smaller or larger or whatever as long as they're fired fish, but they would have to still adhere to bag limits unless we gave an exemption. So we need to address that issue so that commercial operation could operate. And we'll talk about that in the aquaculture rules. Yeah. That concludes.
Any other discussion? All right, committee item number three, Special Delegation Authority. Cup for inland fisheries, statewide. Yeah, statewide, same with statewide. Okay, Ken. Inland and wildlife. Fish, fishes, mine is
Kansas Alpine Inland Fisheries Division, and today I'm here to brief you on some of the fishing regulation changes we're looking at for the coming year. Our first one is Lake Texoma. Our current regulations there for striped bass, we have a daily bag limit of 10 fish. We have no minimum length limit there, 2 fish over 20 inches or greater. The possession limit is also 10 fish. Because all our possession limits are based on the statewide daily bag, and for striped bass it's 5, and currently we don't have any exceptions to that, so the bag is twice the statewide daily bag, which is 10, not the Texoma daily bag. And some anglers were confused on this possession limit. We had some requests on that to take a look at this. Also, we need factor, and we've been working with Oklahoma to try and get our possession. Our size and bag limits the same, and there's some different possession limits there on the Oklahoma side. What we're proposing to look at here for a change is to increase that possession limit to twice the 20, which would be twice the Texoma daily bag. We don't believe that would have any appreciable biological impact. Very few people usually catch the daily bag limits and possession limits. Usually doesn't have much impact on the population. There still would be some differences in Oklahoma, although we have meet with Oklahoma staff, their law enforcement, fisheries group, and so far they're okay with our proposal, and this is something we'll continue to look at with the constituents up in that area. Our next proposal would be creating a new size limit for us, which would be a 16-inch maximum length limit for largemouth bass. Some of the things that we'd be looking at here, we're looking at seven reservoirs at this time that we're looking at possibly putting this limit on. And what we're looking to address by that change is some of these reservoirs have slow growth, either due to low productivity or inadequate sub-slot harvest. And the slot limits that we have on some of these reservoirs just haven't redirected any angler harvest at these smaller size fish, usually on 14 inches or less. That's impacted our harvest of quality fish. We're not getting a lot of bigger fish through the systems. Our size structure overall, what we're looking at for is a good distribution of younger fish and older fish isn't what we want in those reservoirs. And then also, the few of the reservoirs where we're looking to produce some trophy bass, we're not having much success there. Some of the benefits there of the 16-inch maximum, which would be redirecting angler harvest at fish 16 inches and less. We're hoping that by increasing some of that angler harvest, we see some improved growth. We would increase some opportunity for harvest among the anglers, and we would see some improvements in population structure. And also, we would hope to improve some opportunity for a trophy bass catches, such as those fish 21 inches or greater. There are some limitations to this. Regulations or this change may not motivate anglers to harvest. We've seen a lot of reluctance among bass anglers with their catch and release ethic, which has had paid great dividends for a lot of our fisheries. A lot of the anglers have avowed they're not wanting to harvest many fish, so we have to, even in those situations where we're in that slot, we've seen where anglers have been reluctant to harvest those, we would hope that maybe some of these changes would motivate them to do some harvest. And what harvest we would get under there, 16 inches less, still might not be adequate to increase growth. And in some situations, we could experience some over harvest of past 14 to 16 inches. And we would have to address that the opportunity for harvest of larger bass certainly be decreased with the 16-inch maximum. If we didn't set up any situation where we could get certified scales there, such as we do with the Jared Lunkers, where we have our catch and release plates, where we allow anglers, if they catch a Jared Lunker fish, they could turn it over to us or weigh it on a certified scale. We would be eliminating that the harvest of those fish over 16 inches. As I said, we've been discussing this for seven reservoirs. We kind of anticipate that if we do pursue this regulation change, we wouldn't be doing it at all seven reservoirs. We'll probably take a smaller subset of that, and it's something we're continuing to look at with our staff. And certainly all our regulation changes, so we would want to evaluate them after the fact. And this one, since it is a new regulation, it would be somewhat experimental. We would certainly commit to evaluating the success of this one in the future. Those are all the proposals we're looking at this point. If you have any questions on any of those, I'd be happy to address them.
What are the seven lakes you're did I miss that?
No, I just did. One of them is like Bridgeport.
Bridgeport?
Yes, Bridgeport. Bridgeport, Georgetown, Joe Poole, Nacogdoches, Bryan, Hawkins, and Cypress Springs are the ones we're looking at. Some of them currently have minimum 14 or 16, so some of them have either 14 to 18 or 14 to 21 slots. So it's kind of also a broad range of systems there, different productivity, different growth rates, so we're trying to look at among that subset if this was going to succeed, which of these reservoirs would have the best chance for that to succeed and have some impact.
Any other questions? Thank you. All right, Mike Berger. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. For the record, I'm Mike Berger, Director of the Wildlife Division. I'm here today to discuss some, a couple of items that we're thinking about for the 07-08 statewide. First of these is, has to do with the spring Rio Grande turkey season, to modify that to offer better hunting opportunity for hunters. This is an issue that we've discussed with staff. We've discussed with some of the members of the Game Bird Advisory Committee, and before we bring you a proposal in January on this, we'll have more discussions with our staff turkey committee and the full discussion with the Game Bird Advisory Committee. 2 years ago, we simplified this turkey season by merging the north zone and the south zone together into a single zone to increase hunting opportunity by a week. We had had a seven-day shorter season before. As you see there now, it's a 44-day season. And we've concluded that while the 44-day season is fine, the hunting opportunity might be optimized by reinstituting the zone season, allowing the South Texas season to open a little earlier and the north zone season to run a little bit later. And when we come back in January, we would have the specific line and the dates to offer it. The other item is some housekeeping relative to mule deer. And you may recall that about 2 years ago, we adopted rules to eliminate the need for double tagging of deer. Hunters are no longer required to use a tag off their license if they use any one of a number of special tags we had, including MLDs, LAMPS permits, special drawn hunt permits on WMAs, etc. And when we proposed these rules, we inadvertently failed to include the general antlerless mule deer permits. So this proposal, if ultimately adopted, would eliminate double tagging, the need for double tagging of antlerless mule deer taken under the authority of the general antlerless mule deer permits. Also, when we implemented the mule deer program, MLD program, almost 2 years ago, we inadvertently failed to make provision for the archery mule deer season. So we would now propose to change the period of validity for the mule deer MLD to include the archery season for use with archery equipment.
Mike, that didn't have an impact on us this year.
Did not have an impact on us this year. That concludes our items that we have, and I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
Okay. Any other questions?
On the turkey.
Yes, sir.
You're going to run that by the Game Bird Advisory?
Yes, sir. Okay. The meeting between now and January, and we'll run that through then.
Mike, how much did you say that you were looking at moving the turkey season?
Well, don't know yet.
We want to spring turkey.
Discuss that some more. Spring Rio Grande turkey season.
Earlier
move the south zone to open a little earlier, still for 44 days. Move the north zone to stay open a little later than it is now, still 44 days.
I think opening it earlier in the south has a lot of sense.
Yeah. Accommodating the gobble here, is that the idea?
Yes.
You actually want to hunt them? That's it.
Any other questions or discussion?
Thank you.
Committee item number three, Commission Delegation of Authority closed out the summer Gulf shrimp season. Commission fellows.
Okay. I'm going to fill in for Dr. McKinney and do this one. Again, my name is Robin Reichers for the record. This item is a briefing of proposal of rules for permission to publish as indicated. This is in regards to our commission, our authority given to us in Texas Forest and Wildlife Code 77062, which allows the commission to delegate its authority to the executive director. As a side note, and to clarify this proposal, we've been doing this since 1981. We have a joint closure with federal waters, and either in a cleanup or just by purposes that we always have just done it, it's been ongoing for quite some time. We have a joint closure with federal waters out to 200 miles. Since that time, we've had other delegations of authority, and we've explicitly brought those forward in proclamation to make it very clear how that transfer of authority occurs, and that's what we intend to do here again. So this proposal basically is clarifying that and making it consistent with other regulations where we have delegated that kind of authority to the executive director. That concludes that briefing, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions or discussion? If there are no further questions or discussion, I'll authorize the staff to publish this item in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. Any item number four, scientific breeder permit rules, permission to publish?
Scientific.
Mr. Chairman and members, for the record, my name is Clayton Wolf. I'm the Big Game Program Director of the Wildlife Division. I have a couple of brief items, that, housekeeping measures, if you will, I'd like to cover with you this morning. You may recall in April of this year, this commission adopted some sweeping changes to our scientific breeder rules and regulations, basically to better achieve some processes and permitting, and also to address some disease management strategies. When we did that, and since that time, we've discovered one omission and also one change that resulted in some unintended consequences, and so I'm simply here to propose some remedies and ask and request permission to publish these in the Texas Register. First one is fairly simple. The current regulations, which were adopted in April, require that a person need a purchase permit to sell deer. You probably will remember that we abolished the purchase permit and also the transport permit and replaced that with a transfer permit. So we've simply proposed to strike the word purchase from the current rules, and that would make this rule applicable to a transfer permit or any other named permit in the future. The other housekeeping measure is just a bit more complex. Scientific breeders, the current rule allows for scientific breeders to take deer or move deer to other facilities on a temporary basis for breeding and nursing purposes. The current rule restricts that to scientific breeders only. This is not the way it was previously. Previously, before April, a scientific breeder could move a deer to another scientific breeder for temporary purposes, or they could take specifically fawns to nursing facilities for temporary purposes, and those nursing facilities and those people weren't necessarily breeders. In the rewrite and in the consolidation, we simply missed this fact, and so we would propose that the holder of a valid scientific breeder permit could transfer legally possessed deer to or from another scientific breeder on a temporary basis for nursing purposes, and to or from another person on a temporary basis for nursing purposes. And believe it or not, that concludes my presentation. I'll be happy to answer.
That's a record for the deer.
All right, if there are no further questions or discussion, I'll authorize staff to publish this item in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any item number five, artificial reef rules? Tales of me.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, for the record, my name is Dale Shively, Coordinator for the Artificial Reef Program. It's my pleasure today to present to you a brief overview of the Public Reef Building Program, which is a new initiative of the Texas Artificial Reef Program. The purpose of this program is to increase marine habitat in the Gulf of Mexico through the creation of nearshore reefs, to enhance fishing and some limited diving opportunities, to develop reef sites closer to shore to accommodate more small boat fishermen who do not or cannot travel that far offshore, to involve the public in reef building activities, thereby establishing more of a sense of ownership, and to increase overall reefing opportunities. In 2005, the 79th legislature approved House Bill 883 and Senate Bill 455, which set the development of the public reef building program by allowing you, the commission, to the authority to develop guidelines for the establishment of the program. And since that time, artificial reef staff have developed standard operating procedures for the management of the public reef building program and they're available on our webpage. Three workshops were held in June 2006 in Dickinson, Corpus Christi, and Port Isabel to gather public support and input into the public reef building program. And the proclamation language for this program was published in the Texas Register this last September. The need for more public reefs near shore is evident when you look at where most of our current reef sites are located. Currently, the artificial reef program has 57 permitted reef sites, shown here in red, that range from 6 to 100 miles offshore and water depths of 36 feet to over 300 feet. The majority of the sites were created from obsolete petroleum platforms and are located in the High Island area, which is that gridded area up to the right-hand corner. The blue line represents the state line, which extends from shore to 9 nautical miles offshore. Proposed nearshore reef sites will be located in the areas represented by the green blocks on this slide. The strategy is to develop nearshore reef sites out of each major port area along the Texas coast, and these would be the ones that we would start with first. In determining where nearshore reefs should be located, over the years we've listened to the public and will develop sites in state waters as close to shore as possible and in water depths of 60 feet or less. The sites will be accessible from the major ports as seen in the previous slide, and we invite continued public input into the specific reef site locations. This slide represents how a typical public reef would be designed. Each site would be 160 acres in size and divided into blocks approximately 260 feet by 260 feet. The center of the reef site would be marked by a 10-foot yellow spar buoy chained to an anchor. The public would be assigned an individual block to reef their material, and Parks and Wildlife would reef larger materials in between the public reefings. And we would be in a better position to do this, a better position to handle the larger materials than the general public would be. The reef site would be designed so that there is a buffer zone seen here in green in which the general public would not be conducting reefings, but Parks and Wildlife would. And this would eliminate any accidental reefing outside the permitted reef site. For example, the public may be assigned blocks B2 and B4, shown here in yellow, and Parks and Wildlife could reef larger materials in the gray areas, like an A3 or B3 there. Some of the materials the public may reef at their expense could be concrete in the form of engineered designs, such as those commercially available in that top photo. These are known as grouper ghettos, for lack of a better term. The larger materials Parks and Wildlife would use to supplement the public reefings would include concrete in various forms, bridges, bridge spans, those types of items. The public reef building program overall can be reduced to three phases. Phase one involves an application submitted by a member of the public or a group. Reef staff will evaluate the application and discuss the suitability of the material, logistics, and reefing plan with the applicant. Once there's agreement that the material is suitable and the applicant can perform the work, reef staff will make a field inspection of the material and all approved materials will be marked. The applicant will then receive approval to reef the materials at a specific block within that reef site. He'll be given 90 days to reef the materials with a one-time 90-day extension if needed. Once the material has been reefed, the applicant will give Parks and Wildlife the GPS coordinates for each piece of material that they reef at the site. We will then verify that those materials are located in these positions indicated through the use of divers, high scan sonar, and direct observation of the reefing process. During the recent public hearing process, which started in September through today, we've received 19 comments in favor of the public reef building proposal and none that disagreed. That concludes my brief, and I'll be happy to answer any questions you might have.
What if someone sort of put something unacceptable in this area? You mentioned that divers and seismic radar are similar, are used, but then what, if something's discovered that's not appropriate, how's that handled?
We would handle that through a couple of means. One is by the way that the program is developed. We do an inspection of materials before they ever go out. So we pre-approve those materials. Those materials will be marked. That does not necessarily intercept somebody who's going to take something out there illegally. In that case, if materials are put on that reef site that were not approved by us, then they're held accountable through the federal ocean dumping laws. Now, if it goes outside the reef area, unfortunately, the way the program is set up, since Parks and Wildlife is the permit holder, we accept all the liability for that. So we will have to either move that material back in place or expand the reef site to accommodate that, which is not what we would like to do. We have a housekeeping issue that will take care of some of this, and we're trying to build in, when this House bill and Senate bill was approved, one of the issues that was left out was the ability to enforce what is there. And the new housekeeping issue will take care of adding a civil penalty plus some other penalties, and hopefully through that we will be able to manage any kind of issues that come up where material is not appropriate or outside of the reach.
Thank you.
Is this to control dumping? Is that where you're aiming, or are people out welding reefs that are
That type of thing has gone on for years, but that is not our goal. Our goal really is to address public concerns, where we have 57 different reef sites now. The majority of them are offshore, and over the years we've heard from the public that they would like to have a site closer inshore where they don't have to go so far offshore to fish. And Since part of our program deals with rigs to reefs, we're trying to refocus it and build more reef sites near shore within state waters, which would be 6 to 7 to 8 miles offshore. And that's for the benefit of the fishery.
Any group came forward and said that they want to start a process like this?
Yes. Actually, several of them have. On the one slide, let's see if I can go back here, Port Mansfield. There is a reefing group in Port Mansfield that we've worked with over the last few years, and some of the photos in there that show the culverts are in a storage facility there at Port Mansfield. This group was adamant about having their own reef site. We call it their own reef site, but The idea is that they were really interested in creating something near shore. So we've worked with them over the years to permit that site. That site is already permitted.
Yeah.
We haven't moved the material into it yet, but it's set to go.
Any other groups?
There is another group that would sort of tie into this, that actually Mr. Jim Smar is here with the Texas Great Barrier Reef Group, and that concept is to develop a reef system from, say, the Port Arthur down to Port Isabel, allowing for anchorages and ship channels.
And
the connection there would be that they could join up with the reef sites that we've already created or will create. And in theory, we would have this continuous nearshore reef system. in place.
Very good. You like that idea?
I think it's a good concept. We went this route because of the feasibility of trying to get something started and knowing what our limitations are and what we can actually accomplish. And Jim and I have talked many times about this, and I wish him success. We'll support him in any way we can.
Very good.
Yes, sir.
You said that the reefs would be in the water 60 feet or less. Is that their goal? Is that right?
Yes.
And what would be the distance from the top of the reef to the surface? Is there a rule of thumb about that?
There is a rule of thumb, and the reason we say 60 feet or less, right now our shallowest reef site is in 36 feet of water, but we have no material at it. The shallowest permitted reef site that we have material on, we have a 50-foot clearance. And that is an issue that we've worked with the Coast Guard over a number of years. The idea behind this program is that if we move into 60 feet or less, we're going to ask the Coast Guard to reevaluate their rule of thumb and give us some rulings based on location, ship traffic, and some other things, and see how shallow we can actually get it. And in some cases, we're hoping to get a 10 or 15 foot clearance instead of 50.
They just stay out of shipping lanes.
Right. And to get the Coast Guard to agree to a generalized clearance is really difficult. They want to look at everything on a case-by-case basis.
Don't have the Pope.
Any discussion? Good. Thank you. Appreciate it.
This will be moved for
tomorrow. That's the item on Thursday commission meeting agenda for comment and action.
Yeah.
Any item number 6, offshore aquaculture permit rules. Dr. Ray.
What is that item number 6?
Mr. Chairman, members for the record, I'm Dr. Larry McKinney, Director of the Coastal District. The item we have up for you here is consideration of rules for offshore aquaculture permit. I thought this was an interesting slide just to give you some perspective. Let me go on to the next one. This is one of the types of structures you might see off of, kind of like a flying saucer type of thing, with a net there about 50 feet in height, 60 or 70 feet across. This is just kind of neat that you see that central structure there. You can see the feeder, automatic feeder on that tube is opened up there. Of course, the fish are all diving in the feeder, so it's a great, great picture. This offshore aquaculture is something that we think we're going to see more of. It was certainly highlighted in the President's Ocean Plan, although there's some issues now and concerns have been raised about maybe changing, but one of the perspectives that we were concerned about, let me move on there, this is what one might look like from that perspective there to give you an idea of what each one of these net structures look like. But we have, with the idea that folks would be interested in pursuing offshore aquaculture off of Texas, we had no rules in place to help give guidance there, so we had two objectives. One was to prepare and provide a framework for these folks, and if they want to pursue that activity, they could have a business framework to work with and to move forward on. And of course, the other directly aimed at our responsibility is to protect our existing fisheries and populations as well. So that's our two objectives in putting the rule package together. I'm not going to spend a great deal of time on any of the details, just kind of go over the main provisions. Of course, you have those there in front of you. One of the sets of things, of course, in our general provisions, we have definitions of what some of these things are. We make the point that we're only interested in native species. We don't want any exotic species species coming in. That the permit duration would be for 1 year. I'm going to address that in a moment. We're going to recommend changing that. We provide for inspections and how we sample, and then, of course, removal of stock. Within that offshore permit application, some of the requirements, of course, they will be required to obtain all the other permits from other agencies, and believe me, there's a number of them, Department of Ag, Corps of Engineers, Coast Guard, PCEQ, Animal Health. There's a lot of steps to go through with other agencies to deal with this, so we want to make sure that those would be covered. within the facility design, of course, we want to minimize escape. We want to make sure that we're up to date on any disease issues that are occurring. Genetic integrity is an issue for us. We want to make sure that whatever animals are confined in their space confined and do not interfere with the genetic structure of our populations offshore. And then also how they remove their stock as they move forward. Once they have a permit, we have in our rules provisions for how to renew it. Of course, we want to make sure that they've complied with their permit. That would be a condition. That they've actually filled out an application for renewal properly, paid their fee, $1,500 a year is what we're proposing for a permit fee. And of course, that their existing permit hasn't expired, otherwise they'd have to do a new permit. We would require amendments, for example, if you change the species or your source of that stock, if you modify the facility in any way or change your procedure, or of course change ownership, you have to amend that permit to reflect that so we'd be aware of it. Record keeping important, of course, records so we can do our inspections and have an annual report due to us, and of course copies of all their permits and activities. Obviously some things that we would not want to happen, we don't want to fish released out of those structures beforehand. We would want to know about the removal. Give us notifications, so in case we wanted to, we could be offshore to see it. One very important one is disease issues, telling us when potential for disease occurs, so we can check on that. Any kind of damage to the facility, and of course, if they abandon the facility, we have some issues with that. It would be, of course, some reason for denial if they violated our stocking policy or any of our management objectives or didn't complete their application. We lay out the conditions under which we would deny those permits. So. We did have some public comments on these rules, a number of them, and as a result of those comments, we have three changes, and they were very good comments that we wanted to make. One was, some of the comments talked about that our organization was a bit confusing, and in fact it really was. You know, as you write these rules, if you're writing rules, it seems real clear to you, but when someone comes in from the outside, it can seem pretty strange and mysterious, and we agreed with that, we looked at it. So we are restructuring the thing to make it much easier to read in the model, so that was those were excellent comments. There were some concerns about timelines for enclosures. We talked about facilities in our rule. And it was pointed out to us that a facility offshore could have as many, I guess on the maximum, maybe have 100 of these little saucer type things, or probably more like 20 or so. And they wouldn't necessarily harvest or take action on all of their enclosures at one time. They want the timeline to go per enclosure. That makes sense. And so we clarified the fact that we're talking about each of these individual pens. We need to understand that. They don't have to do everything in mass. And the third one is that the business concern is that if they're going out to seek money from banks or loans, that if they only had a one-year permit, that made it very difficult. Obviously, it made sense. So we're providing provisions for multiple-year, three-year renewable permits so they could have that kind of assurance for capital generation. And so we've made all of those adjustments. And if you consider this motion tomorrow, we would include those changes to reflect those comments, which were very good. We did have a couple of comments over disease condition. The folks thought we might have been a little bit too tight on what we wanted to know about in case of diseases. We don't really feel we want to make a change on that right now because this is a new situation for us. We want to be pretty conservative on what they have to report to us on diseases. If we get more comfortable with their situation, we understand things better in the future, as we've done with shrimp, we can back off a little bit. But initially, we want to know what's going on out there on a pretty regular basis and pretty tight, just because disease issues are one of our big concerns. So we prefer to keep our existing proposal in place rather than modify it to back it off a little bit. With that, I'll certainly be glad to answer any questions.
Discussion? Was there any discussion of the difference between a modification, which requires a permit, and repair? I'm a little worried about what you have in it escaping out, and then you can repair it, and it goes through a timeline to get a modification permit and all that. How do you make that distinction?
We haven't yet. And frankly, I think it'll probably be a trial. We clearly don't want them to wait around and not repair something.
Right.
And so that would be something I think we have to take with. I don't think we have to.
What are you going to do if you go out there and you find out a bunch of those fish are swimming out
old, but some boat run by and tore up.
Which, well,
kind of happened.
Yeah, something like that's going to happen at some place. And hopefully, well, one, they don't be losing for that. They got a huge amount of investment in that stock. There's one thing there's actually, they don't want to lose those fish, but once you're in, they got a big thing. They're going to be working hard to stop it. In fact, our inspection will be probably coming frequent. We're going to depend on them to do it. But we're going to report it right away and try to do something about it.
I mean, we can't be sending our people out there.
In fact, the basis of our permit fee, $1,500, that we figure that would cover about one trip a year. With boat calls on, I mean, that's what it is. I mean, we call it, what it covers. But obviously, we're going to do more if we had to, and if we have to make changes, we will. There'll be some escapes, but we're hoping on the scale of things, it's going to be difficult to have as much of a genetic effect with one of these things. We start getting in a situation where they have constantly escaping fish, and that's one of our bases, a violation of our stocking policy. We'll go from that.
Where do they get their main source? Where do they start with their fry?
Well, they're commercial outfits that will sell them. Or more, there will be more and more. Sometimes they're ready to sell. So obviously, so there's commercial outfits that will give these cars.
I'm assuming other states already have law offices enacted. But there is some, offshore.
Mississippi, some of those places are starting to do more of that.
And so have we learned from making their mistakes and have you talked to some of their people?
I've been talking with them, and we've taken where we can find some models. We've pulled some things out of this. But it's still pretty, for us, now overseas, it's been going for a while. And the deep type of fish culture is still fairly new. So we're kind of experimenting. We're leading edge on some things.
And maybe I missed it, but are we defining the type of fish that can be?
Native. They have to be native to species, no exotics.
But anything native to the Gulf of Mexico.
So they can get snapper, trout, redfish.
Yeah, cobia is a big one. A snapper is a possibility. Cobia seems to be pretty hot right now.
If the shell oil rig can get blown over and put out of commission, how do you deal with major weather events and these things?
Well, part of these, things is to, it goes on when I get a, I'm all messed up now, Angel, I'm sorry. wasn't me. It was me, but they're designed to actually drop below surface.
So they don't have to
anything thrown above the surface. I mean, that would be...
Who tells them to do that?
Well, hopefully they would, because
they're watching the weather.
They're going to have several millions of dollars invested in these outfits, so they're not going to do anything to not...
They could be at home watching the Weather Channel and punch a button and make the thing...
I guess they could. Everything, they run a lot of oil rigs.
Larry, I'm very naive in this area, but what's the whole purpose of this? What are we trying to accomplish?
For us, we have two purposes. One is, of course, the aquaculture process is going forward. One is we want to do it in order, proceed in an orderly fashion, and we want to give those folks a business plan. When they lay out their business plan, they have a certainty of path they can follow, so they know they can get their permit to do these things. They can get a permit. They can get in business.
And then what do they do?
The second part is that when you do that, we hope we design our rules point we protect our native stock from diseases, from genetic issues that could occur.
And what will they actually do with the fish? They're going to be feeding them? And
yes, and that. Show you that. I'll mess you up a little.
In other words, they're going to be introducing feed into the environment.
There we go. Thank you. Right there. There's a good example. That's looking inside one of those structures. That big metal central tube is monitored, but also has feeding in, automatic feeders. And you can see there in the picture that off to my right, I guess where you look, you can see the feed falling down into it. You see the fish diving into it. They put those fish in there as fingerlings or something like that, and they grow them until the point where they're commercially viable.
And then they sell them at the
point. They suck them up. They have a ship out there, and they suck them up and are clapped in that, however they're going to do it, and they sell them. It's just like any other aquaculture. So.
Do we furnish the specs? In other words, can that facility be any bigger than 50 by 50, or could they theoretically go 1,000 by 1,000?
That between them and the GLO is for how big an area they'll take. We're not
in
that side of it. There's practical limits, obviously.
the issue of safety for people that are out there, are there safety regulations to where they've got requirements of lights on the surface or something that where somebody's not going to run into?
That's none of our particular business. Ours is the fishery side of it, and I can guarantee you from getting there to Oregon and here to the Coast Guard, they'll have them well covered. There are other agencies out there.
And do we have any input into the type of feed that they're putting in there? In other words, is there, and again, I don't know anything about this, but is it possible that we would not want certain type of feeds being injected?
One of the things I'd be concerned about is, and it's not very practical, live food, what kind of what animals they might be, but that's not practical. They don't do that. It's dead. And so the issues would be more TCQ and water quality. Of course, they're moving offshore because of the water moving through there and diluting pollution type issues. TCQ is, we'll look at that. I think that's probably what you're getting.
Well, but I'm talking about not so much the water as much as could there be feed that's being put out there that may be a benefit to these fish, but perhaps not good for another species. In other words, we're creating a conflict between the feed, and I don't know. I'm just asking the question.
I can't answer that. I don't know. I don't think so. I think that the way they'll spot these things, not much will escape out of those nests because they'll be hungry. But
I mean, it's a legitimate question. I just don't know the answer to that.
Yeah. Or to whether they may be adding, I don't know, fertilizer.
Yeah,
or
something. I see kind of where you're going. I just don't know enough about it.
Larry, the two main, as I understand it, two main objections a lot of conservation groups have with aquaculture is the contamination of genetic contamination of wild fish, and then the amount of prey fish necessary to feed. Right.
There's those issues that in the feed that they're putting together, that they talk about aquaculture being a way to go. Well, depends on what you feed.
Right. Well, propose regulations be addressing those two.
Genetic integrity, absolutely. We're on that. But not the other. There's really nothing we have.
Well, the way you deal with that then is the regulations in the wild harvest of any fish that you'd be using to feed.
How do we ever regulate that, which we don't? Right.
So we don't regulate the type of feed that should
be. We have no authority in that regard.
Even though that feed theoretically could impact our resource?
Well, it seems to me that
to the extent that they're feeding something that could impact our resource, that we would have jurisdiction as part of the permit to say, you can do this, but you can't feed this or that.
If we could make that link that it was, clearly we have under section chapter 12, which why we have that authority. I don't see how I can make that link. At this time, but if we ever were to, clearly we'd be back to you all to say, here's an issue.
Do you know, Larry, whether in other areas where they have this same program, whether there's been an issue of contamination or...
I just don't know. I'll try to find out some answers for it, but I just don't know. That question has not come up with me, and I don't know.
Another recommendation, Larry. David Guggenheim, Heart Research Institute, Gulf Michigan State, is doing some work in the area of sustainable aquaculture, and I know he's...
I know him, and I'll call him, and I'll
get
you an answer to that.
Yeah, I'm just worried whether they may be injecting some feed that may accelerate their growth, or...
Not necessarily that, but
maybe to create some immunities, maybe because of their environment, and then that may impact the resource outside of it. That's
down tomorrow, I'll see if I can find out.
Probably have some of those same issues in freshwater. Frankly, in any captive
animal feeding situation.
Yeah, sure.
No matter how much it's cattle or dogs, there's always that propensity to hit them with the hormones, to hit them with that. That's what they're in business to do. They're in business to make meat
quickly.
Quickly and keep it off. That's it. That's their deal.
Well, to the extent that there is that risk, it seems to me that we ought to have some regulation to where we either pre-approve the feed or we have the right to inspect, you know, and terminate it in the event that it's having some adverse impact or something. I just think it's a significant issue because, you know, they're trying to create an environment, but I have to believe that, you know, whatever they're going to put there is going to go outside the scope of that.
It seems like it's been an interesting discussion because we're on a learning curve.
Right.
We really don't know exactly how it's going to work, and I'm encouraged that, you know, you're going to review and try to figure out these things as some of which we probably won't really know until we get into it.
And I hope that the way we'll go is as we did with shrimp, the shrimp diseases. When we started that, went through that process, very contentious. We laid out some rules that were very conservative, but we worked with the industry and we're working with them here. As we moved through it, we came back to you all about three sessions in a row making changes to make it work. And now we haven't had to deal with those issues for years. This is what I think over here. We're going to learn something. These kinds of issues will come up. We will keep coming back with to you all perhaps. Can I change, make it work?
It seems to me like it is potentially an important industry for the state. Yeah. The amount of host land we have and the pressures on the fishery are huge. And to the extent that this can be an important part of that food source.
Many people are starting to look at it, and particularly in our southern waters, so they have to get it deep enough and close enough inshore, deep enough to make it be. When you move up north, it's too shallow, too far out to get the depth that they need, but
further
south is possible.
Larry, I would really encourage you to look into some of these issues, but, and I said that a while ago about probably some of the same issues in freshwater. I guess my concern there is that what people feed to wildlife is not exactly in our field. I want you to look at the laws and whose responsibility it is, because it gets talking about freshwater, it gets talking about private land, migratory birds, some of those issues.
I need to see what we can, what we have authority over, and what we don't. I'll certainly, just the issue, I'll take a look at for
you. It just seems to me that to the extent that we're authorizing an operation that would impact our resource, that we clearly have jurisdiction over that. I would say it's not necessarily, in other words, whether we're feeding him or whether we're putting a species of fish that's impacting the resource to that extent, and whether, obviously we're regulating it, so to the extent that that operation is going to impact the resource, whether it's by feed or just by the type of fish that we're putting there, that we would have jurisdiction over that.
Well, aquaculture is a little bit different in Texas. It's not necessarily the best way. It's partitioned out. Department of Ag has a piece of it. We have a piece of it. Geolo has a piece of it. Now, whether that's necessarily efficient, that's because of issues that came about. So we have parts of it. And ours is relatively narrow to what we can exclude it, but also narrow, dealing with the stocking and removal and that type of thing. So I'll work with Ann and get that response. But just on the bigger issue, just being concerned about it, I'll report back to you on that as well. Thanks, Chairman.
Further discussion? Good. Place this agenda on Thursday commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Thank you. Item number 7, Raptor Proclamation.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and Commission. My name is Matt Wagner. I'm Program Director for Wildlife Diversity. In August, we published two proposed changes in our Raptor Proclamation in the Texas Register. Those changes were to eliminate the trapping prohibition in Brewster, Culberson, El Paso, Hudspeth, Jeff Davis, Presidio, and Terrell counties. And secondly, to clarify that the falconry permit fees are to be prorated depending on the period of validity, either 1, 2, or 3 years. And this is for your approval tomorrow. Essentially, those are the changes. I'll just let you know we had about 35 public comments, over 90% of which were positive and agreement with the changes. The two or three that we had that disagreed either said our fees currently were too high or too low. So it's a wash. Are there any comments or questions?
Discussion? Okay. Place this item on the Thursday commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Thank you, Matt.
I hope you all know, this commission, is that Mr. Wagner had on his raptor tie.
Any item number 8, harmful or potentially harmful fish, shellfish, aquatic plant rules amendment.
Mr. Chairman, other members of the
Committee, my name is Earl Chilton, for the record, and I'm with Inland Fisheries. What we'd like to talk about today are changes to the structure, the fee structure of our grass carp permitting program. What I'd like to do first is give you a little bit of background information. Triploid grass carp are an important part of our management activities for submerged vegetation in Texas. If you look at the screen, you can see how bad hydrilla can be. Hydrilla is their preferred food, and that picture on the upper right-hand corner is what hydrilla looked like in Lake Austin just a few years ago, before the introduction of triploid grass carp. In 1992, the commission approved the use of triploid grass carp for vegetation management. Since that time, we have issued over 15,500 triploid grass carp permits, the majority of which were for private water. Only 52 of these permits were for public water. That represents the approximately 486,000 grass carp that have been permitted so far. Associated with each one of those permits has been two fees. There's a $15 flat fee for permits in private water, and a $2 per fish fee for permits in both public and private water currently. What are the reasons for the, what were the original reasons for the $2 per fish fee? The first one was to defray the cost of lake and pond inspections conducted by staff. Most of those 15,000 permits were for private waters that were inspected by TPWD staff. The reason for that is we are concerned about escapement in public water, where you don't want the grass carp to be. And there is also some concern about these grass carp escaping into estuarine areas, where they might affect coastal species as well. It's also one of the other purposes is also to provide money for grass carp research. We have conducted some radio tracking experiments with this money, determine where they went and if they were going to escape from public reservoirs, and to provide a fund in case there was some sort of environmental emergency that required our help to remove grass carp or deal with them in some other way. Since the permitting program was initiated, we've collected almost $1 million on this $2 per fish fee. 83% of the money that was collected from private water permits. Well, let's talk about the purpose for the proposed change. What we would like to do is to remove the $2 per fish fee in the case of permits issued for public water only. The rationale for this is, first of all, we would only waive this fee and only approve these kind of permits for water bodies, for larger water bodies, if that water body was operating under an approved management plan, under a management plan approved by TPWD. Also, the removal of the $2 per fish fee in public water would help controlling authorities and others that are helping fund the cost of the triploid grass carp. Some of the controlling authorities that would particularly benefit would be the Lower Rio Grande Valley Development Council, the San Jacinto River Authority, and the City of Boston, as well as the Lower Colorado River Authority. Also, inspection costs. We talked about the fact that each one of those permits required an inspection of the pond, but for public water, those inspections really aren't necessary. Our public waters are on a schedule for surveys anyway. Many of them are surveyed annually. Some of them are surveyed annually, and most are on a 3 to 4 year survey cycle. So our biologists know what's going on in public water already without a survey or an inspection from public waters. And basically, that's it.
Is that for different types of management plans, or the frequency of survey? The frequency of survey, is that for different types of plans that are different?
Yeah.
Annual for some types of plans?
The ones that are our water bodies that have particular problems are surveyed more often. Usually the ones that have exotic species, like hydrilla, urea, water milfoil, water hyacinths, are surveyed a little bit more often.
Discussion? Any questions?
A lot of input from people that live on Lake Conroe and the problems they've got. Will they qualify under this proposal to...
They would certainly qualify.
Okay. What's the downside to having too many of these cars in the lake on there?
Well, the downside is that basically they like anything that's green. If you overstock, they'll eat out all of the vegetation.
Yeah.
When all the vegetation is gone, that's not necessarily good for the fishery, especially the bass fishery, because the vegetation is good habitat for juvenile fish. It's also a good habitat for forage fish, for bass.
I know we went through this before, but in this letter, he refers to the previous methods. This is Conroe. We all got a letter. I mean, I guess we must have included all the pictures. Maybe.
I'm sorry.
You remember? Didn't they come in last? Was it last meeting? The Conroe group.
Yeah.
Previously,
in the letter, it just says here. It says, as urged by property owners since 2004, utilization of Lake Conroe's previously proven methods could have kept new growth of hydrilla and giant salvinia under control.
For the record, I'm Phil DeRosier, the director of Inland Fisheries. There's a long history at Conroe.
Yeah.
It goes back to the 70s. There was some, depends on whose side you're looking at, there were some mistakes made in the 70s, and we paid for those mistakes for a lot of years. What it did was it really made people, especially anglers, fear of grass carp. I mean, grass carp were looked at like it was the worst thing ever happened. All grass carp are a fish that eat grass. They can be a tool, but we're trying to reach some sort of balance. If you eliminate all the vegetation in the lake, what you end up with is water that's a lot greener. You know, your water's not as clear as it was. We can reach some kind of balance of keeping good vegetation and get rid of the bad stuff. That's what we're shooting for.
I think what they were talking about in that letter was the previous use of grass carp when they were overstocked. And in the early 80s, they stocked 270,000 grass carp in the...
He wants many more stocks. Is that what he's
essentially?
He doesn't get into what it is.
We have so far put in about 30,000. We're basing the stockings on the data.
Yeah, you're trying to do it scientifically.
We're trying to do it scientifically. If we see an increase in the amount of hydrilla, we will add more carp. You know, it's going to reach a point where it's going to break over and it'll start going down, same as it did at Austin, we hope. But we have made a commitment to those people. Mr. Cook was there. We have made a commitment that we're going to solve this problem. Unfortunately, if you solve it overnight, which is what they want, you've probably gone too far in one direction.
I think the drive, I remember, because it's gotten way down, particularly in the inlets and where the houses are and all that, so that hydrilla really was all you were looking at.
You're looking at it.
They came in and they were not having this number.
That's a different problem.
Is this representative of what's going on over there?
No, currently hydrilla covers about 4% of the lake. Unfortunately, it's growing in front of
the right front.
Yeah, there's some pretty nice houses.
Carl, if you don't mind, just take a couple of minutes and just tell them exactly where we're all in Conroe, how many acres we believe, what our treatment is, what our plan is.
As of our last survey, we had just under 1,200 acres of hydrilla in the lake. Up until that point, we had approved the stocking of about a little over 14,000 fish. With that increase, we approved the stocking of another 13,800 fish, which would leave the stocking rate exactly what the average stocking rate was in Lake Austin. It was 23 fish per vegetated acre of hydrilla.
That was just about a month ago.
The last of those fish actually went in last week.
So they haven't seen the results of those additional fish.
That's right.
And what you said, 1,200 acres of hydrilla or other. And out of how many acres is the lake? I don't know.
The lake is down right now,
but
it's typically 21,000 acres. Right now it's about 19,000 acres.
And your current number is 30,000?
Well, our current number is a little over 28,000. And if you take mortality into account, we should have about 27,000 fish, live fish in the lake right now.
What's the lifespan of
In Texas, the triploids are a little different from the diploids. Triploids are the sterile ones, and those are the only ones that are permitted right now. But typically, from 5 to 7 years, you get efficacy. We're not sure whether they're dead or whether they just aren't eating as much. The normal fish, the diploids, can live over 20 years.
Part of it is hydrilla, and part of it is
the plant that you saw was giant salvinia. That's the next challenge.
And what do we do about that? They don't eat that.
Well, we're not sure. There's some anecdotal evidence from California that they might actually like it, but hydrilla is their preferred food, so they'll probably concentrate on hydrilla first before they do anything with the giant salvinia. They generally don't like floating weeds as well as they like submerged vegetation.
And do we have a plan on the giant salvinia?
We are just about ready to complete. I finished drafting a plan today, sending it to the San Antonio River Authority, and we're going to have a meeting in a week or two to see if everybody can agree.
I think that's a real important point here. The lake is owned by the San Antonio River Authority.
City of Houston.
Managed by the San Antonio River Authority. Manages, and we are working that plan in conjunction with them and with the landowner homeowner associations in the neighborhood. They're all working together. It's a problem, but we're going to work on it. We're going to solve the problem.
And you know, Earl and the staff have done such a great job there, bringing people together. Not only the homeowners, the river authority, but the angler groups have all come to consensus on something needs to be done, and that was a surprise.
Some of the angler groups have actually agreed to purchase some grass carpet
to help the homeowners in this.
Well, if some of this looks like it's to the point where the anglers would have a hard time fishing it anyway.
John Salvania will be probably have to be treated chemically. Is that correct?
This summer we were using the giant salvinia weevil, and it was starting to work quite well. But basically what we feared happened, they got rain, and it washed it out of the cove that it had been in, so now it's a bad problem. We're using money that we received from the Fish and Wildlife Service to treat it. We're sharing that herbicide with the San Antonio River Authority. So we're going to have two crews out there, and the San Antonio River Authority is going to have as many people as they can get out there spraying it next week.
Did you say that it was 1,200 acres of hydrilla?
That's right.
And how many acres of giant salvinia?
It looked like there were, I didn't get the final numbers from the staff yet. I think there were about 200 acres of giant salvinia.
It just happened to all be in front of these houses?
It's almost all in Little Lake Creek Cove, which is where Bentwater and most of the, or two of the larger homeowners associations are.
Any questions?
They're not happy.
Well, they can't get the boat
in. They can't get the boat in now. Because the water's way down. It's just bad around.
Bill, I place this item on the Thursday commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Mr. Chairman, please.
Thank you. Anything else come before the committee? I tell you, I rake Chairman that heck of a job. I've never seen someone get through the deer agenda so quickly. We should have put him in charge of the race a long time ago. Okay, all right. Nothing else? Stand for me. Thank you, Mr. Cook.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.